Well, Jupiter is probably the best place to look for life because it's got all the ingredients, a lot of room, and plenty of energy. Unfortunately, it's also the toughest place for us to go to investigate. Jupiter is a giant planet, enormous gravity, and I think it'll be probably one of the last places that humans ever go to.
Was there a point in time during the formation of the solar system when Jupiter could have become a star rather than a gas giant?
Unfortunately, no. It's about as big as it was able to get from the beginnings of the solar system. It would have to be something like 10 times larger to really turn into a star.
If we were able to penetrate that cloud cover, what would we find?
Jupiter is covered from pole to pole with clouds, but below the clouds, the gravitational field condenses the gases that are the principal ingredients of Jupiter, condenses those gases until they become an ocean. Picture an ocean 10 times bigger than the Earth, an ocean with no land in it anywhere. And that's what my novel, Leviathans of Jupiter, is all about, the creatures that live in that ocean. They're purely imaginary now, but I really believe that if we could ever penetrate into that ocean, we would find some astounding alien creatures.
And the creatures that you imagine in your book, they aren't just alien on the outside, they're also very alien on the inside.
Yes, as alien as I could make them. They are gigantic creatures, the size of mountains or small cities. They are colonies of creatures, like on Earth, the Portuguese man of war is actually a colony of several different types of creatures that have come together and work in unison. Well, my leviathans are colonies like that. And the question in the novel is, are they intelligent? Could they develop intelligence living in a completely aquatic environment? It's a question we ask ourselves about the dolphins and the whales here on Earth. If they are intelligent, it's of a very different order than ours, and it's hard to communicate with them. Now imagine trying to communicate with gigantic creatures that live in an ocean on the planet Jupiter. We have nothing in common with them, except perhaps a curiosity.
Joining your crew on their voyage to Jupiter, you do have some dolphins, and you have a mechanism through which the humans and the dolphins can communicate. Tell us a little bit about that device and the principle that it's based on.
The principle is reading the electrical signals that the brain puts out and trying to decipher them into some meaningful understanding. The scientists living in a space station orbiting Jupiter have actually brought dolphins with them and tried to communicate with them as a prelude to trying to communicate with the leviathans in the ocean of Jupiter. So the dolphins sort of serve as a go-between, almost like ambassadors.
Another mechanism that the humans use to do their exploration is the idea of perfluorocarbons, of breathing in this material, this liquid, into your lungs that your body can then begin to process and survive. Now, I remember many years ago seeing on television putting white mice into a beaker of this stuff and it swimming around and living quite happily. I think people also saw it in the movie Abyss, the James Cameron film. But how far are we from real practical applications of a concept like perfluorocarbons?
I think the only blockage is why would you do it? Why would you need to do it? It isn't comfortable. I mean, people don't really want to breathe this very thick liquid. It scares you. It scares me just thinking about it.
That comes through in the
Scientists,
book.
you know, scientists are driven men and women, and they will go to extreme lengths to satisfy their curiosity, to do their science. And in my novel, we use perfluorocarbon in the submersible that the engineers have built. The pressures in that ocean are so enormous that you couldn't keep the submersible from crushing if it were filled with air. You have to fill it with something much denser. And that's where the perfluorocarbon comes in, and the human crew has got to breathe that stuff. They don't like it, but they do it.
Another thing I enjoyed were the Jovian fish because they have evolved in direct response to the environment, of course, that they're in. So describe a little bit about what you think that a something swimming around in that cloud ocean might be like.
Well, let me just draw a picture for you. We know that the clouds of Jupiter produce organic particles, food, basically, and these particles drop down from the clouds into the ocean. It's like manna from heaven. So these enormous leviathans live on that. They are grazers, just like the big baleen whales on Earth. But there are also predators. I call them darters. And they are shark-like creatures, again, very large, but much smaller than the leviathans. And they prey on the leviathans. So it's a food cycle, very much like on Earth. And I suspect we'll find similar cycles on other planets that have life forms on them.
Leviathans of Jupiter is a book in your Grand Tour series. What do you picture as being next on that tour?
I've come much closer back toward Earth. I'm working right now on a novel called Farside, which is about building a very large telescope, an astronomical observatory, on the far side of the moon, the side that never sees the Earth. This is the best place to build a very sensitive radio telescope because it's insulated from all the radio chatter of the Earth by 2,000 miles of rock, you know, the diameter of the moon. In my novel, they're also building a big optical observatory, trying to get images of planets circling other stars.
Outside of your career at science fiction, what is your field of expertise?
Writing. I've been a writer all my life.
Okay.
I've worked in the aerospace industry basically as a writer. I was director of marketing for a very high-powered research lab where the first high-powered lasers were invented. And this led me a couple of years ago to write a book called Able One, which is not science fiction at all. It's about a Boeing 747 that carries a very large laser intended to shoot down ballistic missiles. That plane actually exists. It is being tested right now. It has shot down one ballistic missile in a test. And with the North Koreans and other people breaking their necks to build missiles and nuclear weapons, I think it's very important that we develop defenses to protect ourselves.
How far along is an idea like the one you mentioned, Inspiring Farside, the idea of building a radio telescope on the dark side of the moon?
Oh, I know astronomers in Tucson at the university.
Mm-hmm.
The astronomers in the Stewart Observatory have already begun to think about building observatories on the moon. There are some great advantages and a lot of problems. You will get sunshine for 14 days in a row and then nighttime for 14 days in a row. But you get a lot of starlight. There's no air on the moon to block the light. So it's a much better place for astronomy than the Earth. With that little problem that there's no air to breathe, and you've got to carry things up from the Earth until you've got a large enough infrastructure on the moon to begin manufacturing things there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm dealing with in this new novel is, can you build a very large telescopic mirror completely from lunar materials? And I've been talking to some of the astronomers at the University of Arizona. They're giving me some good advice.
What does it mean to you, an opportunity like the one you're going to have at the Student Union bookstore, to meet your readers and to get out and sign autographs? How do you feel about that?
Oh, I love it. I'm very happy to meet people who want to buy my books and read them. If they would like the books autographed, I'm there and I've got some pens.